morning. We're actually probably past a little bit midway through of a series that we're in called Love Songs, where we're walking through the book of Song of Solomon, Song of Songs together. Pastor Matthew a few months ago gave me a choice on the topic that I would preach today. He said, do you want the conflict in marriage talk or the sex in marriage talk? 1,000 out of 1,000, I'm picking conflict in marriage. He's the professional, so come back next week for that. But conflict in marriage. You know, I know this one lands because I'm married, and I know many married couples in this room. It comes out now and again, the kind of conflicts that we have. Conflict in marriage is inevitable. It's inevitable. I think it was comedian Nate Bargatze said, the two easiest places to get in conflict are marriage and prison, right? It's always open 24/7 in marriage to have a conflict any time of day, super easy. And it doesn't even have to be over something big. Married couples, we know that, right? You ever got an argument and a fight over just the most ridiculous stuff? You look back and you're like, wow, why did we it's like we're trying to. You know, early on in our marriage, my wife and I, Shantae, we've been almost 18 years, or 18 years, one of the things we like to do is go date nights, go to restaurants, try new places, eat food, have conversation, and we have this deal where she picks the place, and then I pick the place, right? And, you know, when it's my turn to pick, I say, hey, I've got the place decided, here's where we're going, and she kind of gives me this look like, oh, I'm surprised you picked that, and I'm like, oh, are you not feeling that? That's okay, I can change it up, how about here? And it's more the same. And, you know, I'm throwing out ideas left and right because it's my turn to pick. And they just get shot down left and right until at the end of the day, she just picks where we go with my choice. I think 18 years, I picked one place. And one day, Lord willing, in faith, I'll get to pick again. But those kinds of conversations maybe have caused a conflict or two, right? It's just stupid. It's just small stuff. It can come from anywhere. Married couples, we believe two is better than one. Yes? But two is a lot harder than one. Two is absolutely a lot harder than one. You take two broken people and you put them in a marriage together, expect friction. It's inevitable. If you're not married but you're considering it in the future, you will have conflict with someone for the rest of your life. The good news is you get to choose who you would like that to be. You will have conflict. It is inevitable. How will you manage that conflict? Married couples, how are you managing that conflict? It's an important question. Researchers did this long study, and they looked at two groups of people, two groups of couples, the long-lasting, happily married couples and the couples that didn't stay married. And what they found was actually the number of conflicts between the two groups, exactly the same. There's not a difference in the number of conflicts happily married couples have and divorced couples have. What did make the difference they did found was how those conflicts were managed within the marriage. How we manage conflict makes all the difference. So I want to lead, kind of put forward my two goals for today, and I hope that maybe you would adopt those as your own. The one, we learn actually how to expect conflict and manage it well within our marriage. Maybe you're doing an okay job already. How can you grow in managing it better? Expect conflict and grow in handling it. And then the second goal is to understand that conflict in marriage is one of God's primary tools for shaping you into the person he desires you to be. Conflict in marriage is one of God's primary tools for shaping you into the person he desires you to be. So the first goal is very much between you two. How do we, in the marriage, navigate conflict better? It takes two to have conflict, right? So how do we grow? How do we expect it, but then how do we grow? And the second one is just you. Independent of the other person and their response, God desires to grow you. And conflict is one of the primary tools he has to shape you, to grow you into the person that he desires you to be. So the first thing we'll see is conflict exposes what's inside of us. Conflict exposes what's inside of us. It's kind of like saying pressure shows us what we're made of, right? Conflict reveals things that comfort can otherwise conceal. Our stuff is always there. It's in there somewhere. It sometimes just takes conflict to draw it out. So let's see this play out in the text. Chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. This is the lady in our story speaking. She says, "I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking." Then it goes to the guy. "Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of night." She responds, "I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them?" Okay, so here's what's happening. Remember, this is poetry, right? This whole book is just full of poetry. He's coming home late. She's asleep. But he's been thinking about her all day. He desires her. He's crazy about her. Maybe he's been playing out this moment, playing it out in his head, building this in his head for this moment when he gets home. He comes in, spitting game. "Hello, my dove, my love, my perfect one." And her response is, "In your freaking dreams, Romeo, I'm asleep. Like, I'm tired." She ain't playing nothing out. And if you wondered if the Bible speaks to real marriage issues, welcome to chapter 5. Somewhere around 70% of the conflicts of marriage revolve around unmet expectations. About 70%, give or take, of the conflicts in marriage revolve around unmet expectations. And we see that play out in our text. He expects one thing. She expects to be left alone. And it's important for us to notice that neither of these expectations is evil. It's not like, oh, well, this person's right and this person's wrong. They're just different. And those expectations collide. And the conflict exposes that. And it can expose a lot more than expectations. If we're paying attention, we can see conflict reveal insecurities that we have, past baggage that we carry into the marriage, coping mechanisms that we've built over time that we use to feel safe and secure, and on and on and on. When I got married, I hadn't yet really connected the dots between my past and the adult version of me. I mean, I was 22 when I got married, still kind of a kid. For example, I grew up finding a lot of my security in other people's affirmation. I wanted it, I looked for it, and probably in a very real sense, I needed it in a way. And then I got married and I unknowingly put that weight on my wife. I expected her affirmation to fill something in me that only God could fill. I expected her to heal a wound she didn't create. That's a crushing weight for anyone to carry. And so when she fell short, I would freak out inside. Something in me would panic. I'd get defensive. I'd get frustrated. I'd get hurt. And you can imagine that spilling into conflicts again and again and again. The conflict wasn't creating that problem. That conflict was just exposing what was already inside of me. Now, that's just some of the baggage I brought into marriage. I won't spend time talking about what she brought into it, mostly because I like to stay married, right, and alive. But if conflict exposes what's inside of us, let me ask, what has your conflict been exposing about you? If conflict exposes what's inside of us, what has it been? What's the story it's been telling about you? What's underneath the frustration, the anger, the defensiveness, the immediate withdrawal from the situation that you need to pay attention to? You can grow a ton if you're paying attention, because conflict exposes a lot. Verses 4 through 6, we'll continue on. It says, "My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bowl. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when I spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer." So she changes her mind, and by the time she gets up and goes to let him in, he is nowhere to be found. And so two quick but great practical applications, I think, for married people in this room. The first is from our guy. He didn't try to manipulate the situation to get what he wanted. He didn't try to be the Holy Spirit to convict her. He didn't throw, her vows in her face. "Hey, I've been working all day." He didn't try to manipulate the situation. He valued her for more than just her body. And our premarital counseling, maybe you guys have read this book. We went through the five love languages, right? Great book. I learned that Shantae's was acts of service, which I was horrible at. So I was like, all right, I'm going to get married. I'm just going to do stuff to serve her. I love her. It came from a good place. But I was young and dumb. And so sometimes I tried to use her love language to get what I wanted. She'd come home, and I'd be like, hey, girl, did you see the dishes are done? You know, the house is picked up, the trash is taken out. My love, my dove, my perfect one. Like, I mean, that's manipulative, right? That's not the guy that we read. That's manipulative and self-serving. Like, I'm serving her to get what I want. Jesus never does that to us. Never does that to his bride. He loves us, serves us, lays his life down for us, even when we respond horribly. So the second thing he does, he got frustrated with his unmet expectations. Totally fair, right? It's totally fair. He realized it was a no-go, doesn't manipulate, and then he went away to work through his frustrations with the Lord. He took some space. I think this is a great practical application, mainly for me, but I'll share it with you just in case it meets you where you are. Sometimes we need to work through our conflict with God before our spouse. Sometimes it's a great idea to take some space, work through the conflict, your frustrations with the Lord before your spouse. Not because you're trying to avoid the conversation, but because we're asking God, hey, deal with my own heart before I go deal with the conflict. Often, he's got something to teach us, tell us, let us in on, that will help us. All right, so those are the applications. Okay, so conflict exposes what's inside. But really, exposure alone doesn't really help us. What's next? The real question is, what's next? Second point we'll look at is that humility is the hinge on which conflict swings towards connection instead of contempt. That humility is the hinge on which conflict swings toward connection instead of contempt. All right, so we'll look at verse 9 here. The daughters of Jerusalem speak up, and they say, what is your beloved more than another beloved? O most beautiful among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved, that you will thus adjure us? So they're kind of speaking to her, and there's almost this tone of, like, undermining the relationship. Like, why are you still looking for him? Why not move on? What's so good about your guy? You know, in conflict, we don't just process what's happening. We also absorb the voices around us. And we naturally tend to find the voices that reinforce our bias, don't we? We're looking for people on our side. That's why who you invite in makes all the difference. Will they amplify and affirm your side or push you closer to connection? Will they love you enough to help you see clearly, even if that means challenging you? There's wisdom in inviting others into your conflict, but humility is needed in order to choose those voices well, right? It's in this moment how she responds to her ladies that we see humility swing the conflict towards connection. Our lady responds with some incredible humility. Verses 10 through 16 is her response. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping with liquid myrrh. His arms are wrought of gold, set with jewels. His body, polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns. He's not skipping leg day, right? Set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon. I mean, she just goes on and on. Choice of cedars. His mouth is most sweet, and he's altogether desirable. I love this ending. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. I just love that. It's like she's like, oh, you didn't know? Let me fill you in. This is my beloved. This is my friend. This could have been a moment where the conflict escalated. They're baiting her. What's so good about him? It would have been so easy for her just to pile on, right? Yeah, the idiot came home late. What does he expect? He can be in his feelings all he wants. I don't really care. He always does it. You can just imagine. Instead, she shows great humility, honors him, and we'll see the conflict swings to connection. What an example. This is in the middle of unresolved conflict. She chooses to remember what she loves instead of what frustrates. She chooses to recite and remember what she loves instead of what frustrates. Does he have weaknesses? Sure, but she ain't naming them, and she's not weaponizing them against him. This is what humility does in conflict. It refuses to build a case against the other person, even when there is a case to be made. It resists the instinct to turn differences into division. And that's exactly the mindset of Jesus. You know, Philippians 2, 3 through 5 says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mindset among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus." And so she gives us a picture of what humility looks like in real time. It doesn't mean ignoring the problems. It means refusing to let pride define how you respond in the middle of them. Her response is so powerful. It actually begins to challenge the perspective of the daughters of Jerusalem at the start of chapter 6. You know, at the beginning, they're going, you know, what's so special about him? And at the start of chapter 6, they're like, oh, well, let us help you go find him. And by the beginning of chapter 6, we see that they do find each other. In verses 2 through 3, they're together in the garden of love. She says, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices." She finally finds him. "To graze in the gardens and to gather the lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies." And it goes on to show the man responding to her pursuit of him. And they have reconciliation after their conflict. You know, I think it's important for married couples to take note what doesn't happen when they find each other. She's not pursuing him, looking everywhere, and like, "Oh, I found you. Let's revisit all the reasons really why this is your fault." Like, right? Like, that's not happening. I may have done that a time or two. But why? Because neither of them is actually trying to win the argument. They're not trying to win. They're trying to win each other back. And that's such an important lesson. I think probably it's a lesson you heard of, but sometimes in conflict we forget. If in our conflict we're fighting to win, our spouse loses, the team loses. If you win the argument but lose the relationship, what have you gained? Think about Jesus. Of every person who has ever lived, Jesus had the greatest claim to being right. He was right 100% of the time. Some of us just think we are. He was, right? Every interaction, every conversation, every accusation, he was right, 100 out of 100. And yet he didn't use being right as a weapon against others. What was his posture? He pursued. He loved. He forgave. With his dying breath, he forgave. Even though he was perfectly right, he always moved towards people instead of away from them. And because Jesus has done that for us, we can do the same for our spouse. We can move towards them when they haven't earned it, when they don't deserve it, because Jesus has done that and continually does that for us. But here's the challenge, right? Humility is hard for broken people to have. Humility is hard. It's a great thing to say, oh, have humility, it's the hinge, but it's like, man, it's really hard. You don't know how selfish you are until you're in marriage trying to serve somebody every day, all the time. We live in a world also that constantly trains us to think of yourself first. Think about you. What do you want? What's true for you? What's good for you? To be self-centered. And we know, honestly, just take a step back. You don't even have to be a follower of Jesus. We know on a large scale, that kind of operating system does not work. You have 8 billion people, the center of their own universe. Is it going well? Like, nobody in culture is like, man, we're crushing this. Like, nobody. But when what's true on a global scale is also true on a personal scale. We weren't made to be the center of our lives. We live in one of the most individualistic cultures in history, and also, self-admittedly, one of the most unsatisfied. We know there's something more, because we're not meant to fill the hole in our heart. That tells us something. It tells us the operating system is off. The Bible repeatedly warns us that life starts to unravel when we put ourselves at the center, because we were made to know, worship, and follow Jesus instead. That's why when Jesus came, he says, "I've come to give you abundant life, not with us on the throne, but with him as king." We need humility, and yet we live in a world that constantly pulls us the other way. So how do we grow in humility? So I want to end with just 4 quick practical applications Again, to help with our goal, to help us with our goals of growing and handling conflict well, and also us growing individually through what conflict exposes. Okay, so the first application. If you want to navigate conflict in a healthy way for the long haul, you need an active, growing relationship with the Lord. I know that might sound bold if you don't have it. Let me explain. The kind of humility, grace, and selflessness that sustains a marriage are produced by abiding in Jesus, not by trying harder. The kind of grace and humility and selflessness that you need to sustain a marriage are found in Jesus, not by just simply trying harder. In the short term, anybody can show humility, right? Anyone can learn humble behaviors and put others first and do loving things without even being a Christian. That happens all the time. You can show humble behaviors. But if what we've done is simply learned humble behaviors without having a humble heart, eventually what's underneath will get exposed through conflict. Behavior modification is short-lived. We need transformation. The good news is that Jesus doesn't tell us, hey, go be humble. As we walk with him, he begins to make us humble. He begins to produce grace, mercy, patience, forgiveness, and selflessness in us because those are the very things he continually gives us. It's difficult to consistently extend grace and forgiveness when we're not walking in it. And maybe you're here today, you've never said yes to following Jesus. The story we've seen in this passage, it points us to something bigger. While we've pushed God away and there's relational distance, he pursues us. While we've wandered, he has moved towards us. While we've broken a relationship with him, he has made reconciliation possible. And it's all through the person and work of Jesus. So how do you start a relationship? Humility. God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. So draw near to God, admit your need for him, trust in Jesus, start to walk with him, recognize what he's done on the cross. I mean, that's his reconciliation. That is his pursuit. And receive the free gift of forgiveness and grace. So that's the first point. Like, nothing really after this will make sense unless we get the cornerstone in place. Second is a two-parter, so I guess it's two and three maybe. Grow in self-awareness and own your part. Actively try to grow in self-awareness and own your part. One of the most helpful questions you can ask is, what's it like being on the other side of me in marriage? Just stop and think, like, what's it like being on the other side of me in marriage? That takes intentionality. Like, it really does. Because most of us naturally elevate everybody else and evaluate everybody else before we start to evaluate ourselves, right? Well, here's what they're doing. Here's what they could do better. Like, that's just natural. To actually turn that on us and go, man, what's it like being on the other side of me? Takes a lot of intentionality. But when you honestly examine yourself through somebody else's perspective, you start to see your own blind spots. Maybe it's my tone. Maybe that was pretty harsh. Am I normally harsh with my words like that? Maybe it's body language. Maybe I treat a preference I have like a moral issue because they don't do it my way. Actually, they're wrong. Mine's the right way. Make space to ask that question. What's it like being on the other side of me? Because the more you become aware of your own weaknesses, actually, you start to look across the marriage and be more compassionate towards your spouses. And then own your part. Own your part. One of the first effects of sin entering humanity in Genesis is blame shifting. Adam, what's going on? That's this woman. Woman, what's going on? It's the serpent. Nobody wants to own their contribution, right? I see this every day with my girls. I have twins that are 9 and my oldest is 11. Man, they are in prime fighting age. It is, if you ever see me and I look exhausted, I mean, it's just my day. Like, that's just, I'm just the referee in fights all day. You know what I've never heard when I've stepped into the middle of a conflict between them? Dad, I lost my emotions. I just lost control. I said things I shouldn't have said. That's me. That's my bad, Dad. No. Well, you know what I hear? She said, she did, she always. Nobody's owning their stuff. And honestly, adults, like if I looked in marriages, my marriage, our marriages, we kind of sound like that kids, right? Like, she does, he does, it's always him. We're not that different. We're often experts identifying our spouse's faults and beginners at owning ours. Humility asks a different question. What's my part to own? And am I managing that responsibility to the best of my ability? Because I can recognize it, but I don't want to own it. So what's your part to own, and are you doing your best at managing that responsibility? You can't control your spouse and their response, but you can own yours. Third, invite others in. Invite others in. Marriage, man, such a gift to be around other people who go through some of the same stuff that we go through and same frustrations and same battle of selfishness. And one of the ways pride shows up in marriage is that we tend to isolate. We convince ourselves, we can handle it. I can handle it. We tell ourselves, it's not that bad. We put on a mask and we just act like everything's fine. But humility is willing to lower the guard, put down the mask, and admit, things aren't as fine as I pretend. And here's the truth. In doing that, you won't be surprising anyone. The struggles in your marriage, the conflicts you're facing, the things you're wrestling with, there are countless other couples in our church who have walked through similar things. Conflict is inevitable. None of us have it all figured out. Humility is being willing to say, yeah, we're stuck. We need help. In fact, that's one of the reasons we have life groups. It's one of the reasons we try to do life together. Not because we have life figured out, but because we're all trying to grow closer to Jesus, and we need other people walking alongside of us as we do. I'll say this because usually one spouse notices something is off before the other is ready to admit it. If one spouse, one side of the relationship is saying, hey, I think we need counseling. I think we need other people, or another couple to walk with us. And the other's like, nah, I'm good. You can go. I'm good. Man, that's pride. Because there's no his problems and her problems in marriage. There's y'all's problem. Marriage is a team sport. And when one person is hurting, struggling, raising concerns, humility steps towards the problem, not away from it. And maybe the most humble thing some of you can do this week is invite somebody else in. A trusted friend, a mentor, a pastor, a counselor, not because your marriage is failing, but because healthy marriages don't pretend they are without problems. They deal with them. So lastly, the last application is, be willing to take the first step. Be willing to take the first step in pursuit and a reconciliation. One of the most damaging lies in marriage is, I'll move when they move. I'll apologize when they apologize. I'll pursue when they pursue. But if both people are waiting, nobody moves. You know, after the conflict in Song of Solomon, there is distance. And Our Lady takes the first step. She steps in, she pursues. That's hard to do. Because pride wants justice. I'll take that step when they admit. I'll take that step. No. Pride says, they hurt me. They should come first. Humility says, what if I took the first step? Now, taking the first step doesn't mean pretending nothing happened. It doesn't mean ignoring sin. It doesn't mean accepting unhealthy behavior. It simply means I value the relationship and reconciliation more than being right. For some of you, the first step is an apology. For others, it's starting a difficult conversation or sending a text or sitting down tonight and saying, hey, we've been distant. I want to change that. Don't underestimate the power of one small step towards someone. And that's exactly what Jesus did for us. When there was conflict because of our sin, he didn't wait for us to clean ourselves up to then pursue us. He pursues us, and when there was distance, he closed it. And through the cross, he made reconciliation possible. You know, if you notice, you kind of have a theme going on here. Conflict, there was distance, there was pursuit, and there was reconciliation. That's the movement of Song of Solomon chapter 5. That's the movement in our marriages, and that's the movement of the gospel. Though our sin created distance between us and God, God did not stay distant. He pursues. Through Jesus, we have the possibility to be reconciled to a holy God. Romans 5, God shows his love for us and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He moves towards and pursues. He made a way when there was no way. So let's pray and ask for his help so that we can do the same. Father, we come to you. God, I come to you. I can't do this on my own. We can't do this on our own. You know, left to ourselves, we defend, we withdraw, we keep score, we build walls. And our marriages, God, we need your help. You know, for the marriages in this room where there's distance and there's hurt, there's frustration, would you do what only you can do? Would you give us humble hearts? Help us to see not only, you know, what our spouse needs to change, but what you want to do in us. Would you soften our hearts? Would you restore what feels stuck? And give us courage to take the next step towards one another. God, may our marriages reflect the gospel. Would they have that same movement in our marriages as your movement towards us? The God who pursues, the God who reconciles, the God who loves. God, we love you. We thank you that you never leave us alone. You never leave us stuck. It's in your name I pray. Amen.